will global banking regulation shape up after COVID-19? Welcome to Global Risk Regulators, podcast series about banking and financial regulation. For more about GRR, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. In this episode, we are discussing how the regulatory landscape might evolve once the pandemic has passed. Regulators have already taken a series of measures, such as delaying some regulatory implementation deadlines, temporarily loosening some capital standards, and relaxing some reporting requirements for banks so they can focus on supporting businesses and households. The question is, do these changes set a new trend, or will they just be temporary? To help shed some light on these questions, I am delighted to welcome David Strachan, the head of EMEA's Centre for Regulatory Strategy at Deloitte, and I also have the great pleasure in welcoming Michael McKee, who is a partner at DLA Piper. Okay, I'll start with you, Michael. So do you think that the economic fallout from COVID-19 poses a threat to global financial regulation, making jurisdictions more likely to pursue their own solutions, such as more easing of capital ratios and delaying the implementation of timetables for longer, basically leading to a long-term fragmentation of global rules? I mean, what's your view on that?
I would look at the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic as sort of covering three big areas. One is delay, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Second is dividends, and the third is default and the implications of default for capital. Definitely on the delay front, clearly most countries, in fact, the Basel Committee itself has proposed delay of most things by a further year.
Yeah.
And if you have delay, that gives, shall we say, more scope, more time potentially for more differences to arise. So that's number one. Dividends, I think, is not so much an issue for the Basel Accord itself, but obviously one of the implications of the pandemic has been that regulators have gone around strong-arming banks and telling them that if they're going to be getting various relief on their capital, they can't pay out dividends to shareholders during that period. So I think that is a sort of a significant issue, although not maybe one we need to talk about so much today. Sure. And the third is default, which I think is a very big issue, yeah. Which is with all of these payment deferrals and various other steps taken, how do you tell what you might call the bad loans that were always bad loans from the loans that are just going to have the borrowers that are just going to have temporary issues? So I think default is a very big issue. Does it mean long-term fragmentation? I think it will mean increased tension, which may or may not result in long-term fragmentation. So those would be my points.
Okay, fine. Thanks for that. Well, and David, what's your view on the sort of fragmentation theme?
So on that theme, I mean, I think we have to recognise that in some respects the global regulatory community isn't starting from the best position. I think we're well past the peak of post 2008 financial crisis regulatory convergence. Yeah. So that's an important backdrop. And as Michael says, consequences of COVID-19 could compound that. But I think the real question is, how likely is the threat that you mentioned, Justin, to become a reality? And there, I think it's a wee bit too early to tell. On the positive front, we've seen the Basel Committee, as Michael said, pushing back the implementation deadline for Basel 3.1 by a year, and that's helpful. It also was the first, I think, to advocate allowing greater use of the transitional provisions in relation to expected credit loss arising from IFRS 9, which is also positive, so you're taking the lead there. But on the other hand, I mean, pretty much all the regulatory flexibility and forbearance measures have been taken at either national or EU level. By definition, all the government support schemes have been national. And I think there's a risk that that may encourage a bit of what's often referred to as home bias. So banks lending into their domestic markets more than cross-border. And then lastly, if countries are concerned about long and complex supply chains and dependencies on other countries for sort of critical goods and services, then I think some of that thinking could certainly rub off onto financial services regulation. So I think Michael put it quite nicely that there are sort of some tensions on the horizon that are probably going to get bigger.
Right. Okay. David, let me stick with you a bit longer. Let's unpack this a little bit. And let's talk maybe about developments within individual jurisdictions. So let's start with the US. Now, as we all know, under the Trump administration, they have been pursuing a deregulatory agenda. For instance, they've been making reforms to the Volcker Rule. More recently, they decided to temporarily exclude bank holdings of US treasuries and bank deposits at the Federal Reserve from the supplementary leverage ratio. Now, some people I've been speaking to, they've suggested that this could become permanent, which I believe would contravene Basel rules. So, I mean, do you expect further temporary or even permanent divergences from whatever jurisdictions are doing? And I know this is complicated a bit by an election this year as well. But you know, what's your view on that?
So, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. Again, as I did in the last one, I think it's important to think about the context, in particular the context for deregulation. I think a number of commentators and regulators in the US might argue that the regulators there have actually gone well beyond what was strictly required of them by Basel and by the Financial Stability Board. So then if you accept that, then their deregulation is actually starting from a higher base than you might find in some other countries. But and I think your point you make about the leverage ratio is a nice one, because I mean the US has had a binding leverage ratio for a number of years now, whereas the European Union, on the other hand, hasn't yet introduced one in binding form. That's going to take effect, I think, next June in the European Union, against the Basel Committee deadline of January 2018. So if you take those two situations, I mean, we could spend quite a lot of time discussing which is more divergent right there. But I mean, going back to your question, I've certainly spoken to quite a few people in the US. And again, while it's possible that that temporary measure might become permanent, I don't think they see any reason to believe that that's going to become permanent, at least now, at least not as they see the outlook right now.
Okay, fine. What's your view on the US situation, Michael?
Well, the first thing is that I would agree with what David says, that in certain aspects, the US is imposing, shall we say, higher thresholds than Basel itself requires. In that regard, I think it's a fair point that even if they diverge to some degree, in certain other respects, and as David says, that's not absolutely guaranteed. Broadly speaking, one would expect that the overall outcome would be that the US would be, broadly speaking, still in line with Basel III, and would be, generally speaking, even if they deregulate, probably not deregulating to a point below what you might call the baseline for Basel III. So that's point one. The second point I'd make, and I think this is a more general point, but is relevant perhaps to what we'll discuss later on as well about other areas, is that nobody really implements Basel III exactly as agreed. Every country, or in the EU's case, every sort of set of countries implements typically on a national basis. And every time that happens, politics comes into play. Often the biggest changes you get in terms of implementation are dictated more by, shall we say, the politics of the day. You know, a good example of that is that when CRR came in, Basel bankers' bonuses, a provision in relation to that was introduced, which of course was not required by Basel III, but was a political concern in the context of, you know, the post financial crisis of 2008-2009. Yeah. So the same thing happens in the US when they seek to implement Basel III. It will be partly dependent on the politics in the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Michael, can I take you over to the EU now? So as we know, they rely, European economies rely heavily on banks to support the economy, much more so than the US. They also want to place a Green Deal at the center of economic recovery, which will undoubtedly involve banks. We also know that they don't like some Basel measures, such as the output floor on internal models. They also hold numerous exceptions to Basel rules. So where might EU regulators be tempted to diverge further from the Basel framework in pursuit of their economic goals? And I guess a lot of that also depends what happens to economic recovery.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the first thing is that at the minute, of course, the EU's primary focus in this area is actually on the CRR amendments proposal that is going through the Parliament and the Council as we speak.
Okay.
And that is very much focused on the facilitation of lending by the credit institutions into the EU economy. So that's where their focus is at the minute. And one would expect, particularly given that it looks like the EU economy's most hit by coronavirus will be places like Spain, France, and Italy, that there will be political pressure both by some governments, by various MEPs, but also by banks, and maybe not just in those countries, but particularly in those countries, for some aspects of relief from some of the requirements of Basel III.
Yeah.
So now, whether that actually translates into actually, for example, changing aspects of the output floor is another matter. I think what is more likely to be negotiated is delay as to the phasing in of the output floor and things like that. And obviously, Basel itself has already pushed back the phasing in of that by a further year. Mm. But that's certainly an area where, on the one hand, the issue will be, do they do something other than the output floor? My guess is possibly not, because that is such a key component of Basel III. It's more likely, I suspect, to be something around, shall we say, a certain amount of supervisory flexibility in some aspects of how the internal models are operating, but we'll see about that. The other area, as you say, is what I might call green finance.
Yeah.
So the EU is very, very keen, obviously, to encourage green finance, but they're also keen potentially to give preferential treatment, shall we say, to certain types of green assets finance, which might include lighter capital weightings for certain types of product. So that's an area where we might see developments, it seems to me, but that partly is itself dependent on the work that is going on again at the minute in Brussels in relation to developing the framework for green finance and whether or not, for example, those sorts of advantages for certain green products are built into that framework.
Yeah, no, indeed. Okay, and David, what's your view on the sort of EU situation?
So, I think that there are probably two types of divergence in broad terms. One is divergence on timing of implementation, and the one on the substance of implementation. On timing, I think the Basel Committee has helped in terms of delaying its implementation date by 12 months. I mean, our own view has always been that the EU had very little chance of hitting the January 2022 deadline. It's still going to be tight for 1st of January 2023 in our view, but it's much more possible. So that's timing. On the substance, Michael's covered the output floor very clearly. I mean, I think one other area I would just look at watch carefully is treatment of unrated corporates, where in some respects the new standardized approach and other approaches have got some tougher treatments of unrated corporates. And given what's happening now to corporates, in particular small and medium-sized enterprises, will they be inclined to see if they could find a way of smoothing that impact? I think that's one to watch. I mean, the other area which is quite topical is around the Capital Markets Union and the high-level forum set up to advise the Commission on the Capital Markets Union Phase 2 reported yesterday or earlier this week. And they're advocating that the Commission looks at changes to the capital treatment, which would enable it or make it easier for banks to make markets hold inventory of securities, and also to think very carefully about the treatment of banks' holdings of equities, particularly long-term equities. So I think you may find that there is the coming together of the CMU and the European Union's implementation of Basel III gives the European Union an opportunity to look at some of these specifics.
Yeah, no, it's interesting points, actually. And maybe, David, if I can now switch you over to Brexit. I mean, you've given a lot of thought about it. I know Michael has as well. You've been advising clients. You've all been thinking a lot about this. So, you know, what direction do you think UK regulators might take? And, you know, let's put this in the context, you know, the dreadful impact of COVID-19. You know, GDP was reported to have fallen 20% in April. It's an absolutely shocking number. In light of all this, is there a chance now that the UK government might, after all, pursue a deregulatory approach to help spur growth?
So, as of today, I mean, it seems to me that the UK regulatory stance is clear, which is, you know, had the PRA and the Financial Policy Committee not implemented the robust capital and liquidity standards that were introduced after the last crisis so rigorously and robustly, then the UK banking system wouldn't be able to withstand and respond to the current situation in the very proactive way that it's doing. And I mean, my sense is that left their own devices, the Bank of England, the PRA, would want to implement global standards faithfully and consistently and tailor them to what the UK needs. Having said that, I think they'll do that sensitively. And you know, we have seen in the measures that the UK regulators have already taken in the last few months that they do not want capital regulation to be procyclical and stand in the way of lending to the real economy. But so they are sensitive to that. I think their adherence to global standards seems to me to be pretty loud and clear. And I mean, there's an interesting case in point at the moment, which is Michael mentioned, that what's often referred to as the quick fix package. For CRR2, where the European Union has moved very quickly to introduce a series of measures to amend capital requirements, one of which is a less draconian treatment of banks' investment in software assets. A technical issue, but it's an important issue. Where the Bank of England, Sam Woods, the Deputy Governor of for the PRA, said a couple of months ago that was one area where the PRA had in previous discussions taken a different view. He said that they lost that argument in the EU28. Setting, and clearly I think the UK regulators are now going to face a question, do we go with the EU or do we stick with our sort of instincts on that one? We'll have to wait and see. I mean, just to round off, where the government comes out on this, I think we really, on that one, we wait and see what the consultation on the financial services, which we're expecting later this year, has to say. But clearly, they set the overall direction and framework for the regulators.
Okay. Well, Michael, what's your take on the UK post-EU, post-COVID-19 in terms of its regulatory structure?
What I think, really just picking up what David's saying, is the first thing is, to your point on GDP and the drop in it and what the government might do, I think the Chancellor spoke to the 1922 committee earlier this week, and the reports on that I've read from the Times, for example, indicate that he's certainly putting together a package of changes to boost the economy in the sort of coming out of COVID context. But I don't get the sense that includes specific changes to the course of regulation. Mm-hmm. And indeed, just as David said, I think that actually the current UK position of the regulators is pretty clear. And the best way to see that is if you look at what the PRA published in March and then more recently in June in terms of guidance on the approach the banks should be taking to expected credit loss and payment deferrals and such like in the current crisis. So there are two big points on that. The first thing is they made it clear in Sam Wood's covering letter that had been done by taking into account the Basel Committee and in dialogue with the Basel Committee. It had also been taking into account the EU position and the position of the EBA and their guidance. That all of that guidance that has been put out by the PRA is clearly intended to be consistent both with the Basel Accord and how that is developing, with IFRS 9, and certainly for the present, with CRR. And the other thing that is mentioned there is the EBA pathway, which of course runs on for several years beyond the period point at which we in the UK will be part of the EU. So I think the current and likely course of action in relation to capital for the UK for the next few years is to keep on keeping on, certainly in line with current CRR and in line with Basel III.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, well, Michael, maybe I can get you to sort of give your views on this one. There are certainly some divergences going on. I mean, everyone is kind of looking after their own jurisdictions, as they were, because we're all in a sort of economic crisis or lockdown and trying to get out of that. Do you think there's a threat that the Basel framework, could eventually unravel as a result of all of this?
There's no doubt tensions are going to be created. I think David and I both agreed on that earlier on, and that those are more likely to be political tensions, it seems to me, rather than regulatory tensions, but the political tensions tend to affect the regulatory position because ultimately the regulators have to conform to whatever is the political policy line within their own jurisdiction, even if they have a degree of independence from the politicians. However, I think you've got to look at this in the context of the development of the Basel Accord over many years. You know, we're now at Basel III. If you go from Basel I to Basel II to Basel III, in each iteration, you've had a more detailed, a more complex, but at the same time, an improved, shall we say, Basel Accord as the outcome. There are always difficulties with implementation, and nobody does implement it, or very few, exactly as the accord requires. The key issue is whether the degree of divergence when it comes to implementation is so excessive that, as you suggest, you know, it could result in an effective breakup of the way the accord operates. Yeah. I personally think that central banks, who generally speaking are the, shall we say, the guardians of the Basel Accord, are actually themselves keen for it to continue to work effectively for the future. And therefore, if there is a fundamental problem, it will be at the political level. It will be because global politics itself becomes so charged and so difficult. Yeah. That then it is not possible to continue with what is, you know, actually, if you think about it, you know, the Basel Accord operates better than the United Nations for the moment.
That's very true, actually. Yeah. Okay. And David, do you think the Basel Accords are in danger at all?
So I think there will be a role in future for a global bank capital framework, for many of the reasons that Michael gives, and also as a sort of benchmark for national regimes. We should remember that the IMF, when it does the financial system assessment programs, uses the Basel framework as a benchmark against which to score national regimes. But having said that, I mean, I think we do see sustained and substantive divergence over a period of time. Then, I don't think there's any doubt that the authority of the framework would certainly be eroded. But I don't think we're anywhere near that point point yet. Let me stop there. That's my quick take on it.
Right. Okay. Okay. Michael, if I could come back to you. So, you know, let's try and end this on an upbeat note, so to speak. So, you know, if jurisdictions are to find common cause once again, try and align their regulatory policies, what do you think needs to happen, or what could happen to drive that? To drive a sort of reconvergence?
I think the key thing is, in some respects, is to keep doing what they're doing, which is in the context of the Basel Committee, there is a continual and ongoing dialogue and process. And each time a new Basel Accord is agreed, then the big issue is how in practice do you implement that? And there's a very close interrelationship here, not just with the general capital framework under Basel, but in certain respects with international financial reporting standards or equivalent, you know, standards like US GAAP and such like. Yeah. So the other element here is finding ways to ensure that when you implement, you do those in practical and sensible ways. So if we go back to what I mentioned, for example, about the PRA guidance, that, for example, I think is very helpful in working through some of the concepts, for example, in IFRS 9 on expected credit loss and significant increase in credit risk. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, when, for example, do you trigger a move from treating a loan as performing, as it were, and therefore in stage one, and then moving it up into the higher more difficult stage is stage two, where you basically say there is a significant increase in credit risk, and then stage three, where you're more or less saying it's in default. Yeah. Now, they therefore look at, you know, the new schemes in a UK government context, but this could be equally potentially applicable, for example, to European schemes. And they say, well, the mere fact that you give payment holidays or additional credit under these schemes should not in itself trigger a view that there is therefore a significant increase in credit risk. So there's some very thoughtful and sensible guidance that should assist banks. But if you look at that, that is also part of working through the process of implementing both IFRS 9 and aspects of Basel III and the new definition of default. So that sort of dialogue, that working together, that continually looking at issues, and if necessary in a Basel situation, from time to time, adjusting them, that has to continue. And I think, therefore, there is this continuing massive role for the banking regulators and the banks actually as well to continue a strong dialogue, whatever the political environment they find themselves working on, even if it's quite a tense one.
Okay, lovely. And David, what do you in your view could maybe drive a reconvergence, around regulation around the world?
Justin, I'll give you a couple of variations. I'll give you a pessimistic outlook, and I'll give you an end and a more optimistic note. Mm-hmm. So I think what might bring them to get back together, if we take the sort of pessimistic path. So I think if we find ourselves continuing down the fragmentation route, by which I mean sort of national policy, national ring fencing of capital and liquidity or of operations and data, then it may well require a significant event where fragmentation is either a contributor to the whatever caused that event. For example, liquidity or capital couldn't move to where it was needed because it was trapped by a national regulator, or indeed where the impact of the event is made a lot worse. There's just more destruction of economic value than it otherwise would have been the case. Then I think that sort of shock might actually cause some national regulators to think this is not the right way to go. So that's the shock channel. But I think there's also an opportunities channel, which is that there is a growing recognition, notwithstanding the political tensions that Michael mentions, that actually there are some enormous issues that would be better dealt with globally today. And on my list, I'd have climate risk, where the network, the greening of the financial system is very active. Yeah. There's operational resilience, which clearly, after what we've experienced over the last few months, is very critical, increasingly important. And stable coins. We saw last year how quickly the regulatory community came together when it was responding to the proposals put forward by the Libra Association. So I think it is possible that there are some cutting global issues which the regulatory community will tackle on a global basis. And even so, for the reasons we've been talking about, some issues such as bank capital are going to remain quite tricky over the coming months and years.
Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank Michael and David for taking part in Global Risk Regulators Regulatory Podcast Series. And if you'd like to listen to more regulatory podcasts, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And you can also subscribe via Acast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.